and welcome to CSTW's podcast and broadcast of Writer's Talk. Today, I am visited by Hassan Kwame Jeffries, who was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and went to school at Morehouse and Duke for undergrad and graduate school, and has gone on to write a book, Bloody Lounge, the Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. And he's going to talk to me today about the book and writing and the things that he's doing. He's also, I should mention, an assistant professor of history at Ohio State University and the dual appointment with their Kerwin Institute for Race and Ethnicity. Did I get that name correctly, the whole thing? Okay, good. So welcome today, Dr. Jeffries.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Great. Well, and I'd like to start off by asking you to tell me about how this book came about. It seems like it's got a lot of footnotes. You've got maybe 50 pages worth of footnotes at the end.
Right.
I don't know if that's exactly it, but a lot of detail, a lot of research went into the book.
Right.
Is this something that was part of your dissertation or something that came out after?
It started out as a project in graduate school. It was a part of my dissertation work and research. And then when I sort of completed the dissertation, thinking about writing, I thought the conversion from dissertation to book would be adding a couple commas and some punctuation here and there. And so 4 or 5 years later, after I completely rewrote the thing, that's what we wind up with in the final book format. Okay. But as a historian, part of our craft, part of what we do is to research. So before we can even get to the writing, there was a couple of years of research, just finding the history, documenting the history, and then using that as the basis to write the book.
Tell me about that research. I mean, you're meeting with people, you're talking with them. How did that happen? What kind of ethnographic techniques did you use? How did you find the people that you wanted to interview?
Well, there was a mix. There was a mix of sort of research methodologies. I mean, the first that I used was what historians are trained to do, regardless of subject, and that's just the traditional archival search, looking at microfilm, looking at newspapers, going to the state Alabama Department of Archives and History, state archives, not only in Alabama, but then also very special collections, Library of Congress and the like. So it's just a lot of page turning and trying to get the skeleton for the history of the county. Although I write about the sort of civil rights movement and social organizing in the African-American community, I mean, really to tell the story, I had to reconstruct the history of the county. And in order to do that, I had to go into the archives. But once I got the skeleton of the story down, or I had a sense of who the people were, when things happened, through that archival research, then I was able to go in, talk to people on the ground, not only local people who had lived there, who had lived through the movement, but also SNCC organizers, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, those civil rights activists who went into Alabama in the mid-1960s and worked with the local people.
And you mentioned locals. I'm curious about the role of outsiders and its relation to the locals. Outsiders were very important to the civil rights movement in Alabama, but how did the locals feel about the presence of that? Did you get a lot of reaction to things like that as you're talking to the people on the ground?
I did, and dependent upon who you asked, because this obviously is one county, one community, but within that one community, there are various different groups. I mean, you have the white community, you had the African-American community, you had within the African-American community different class divisions. So depending upon who you were, there was a different level of receptivity. On the white side, back in the 60s, 1965, when SNCC organizers move in, there was great hostility towards them. I mean, as outsiders, they were dubbed outside agitators. And that's a long history. I mean, because of the long history of exploitation of African-American laborers in the South, and particularly in these rural areas, there was this sense that African-Americans would be content with their position and status in life as long as outsiders did not stir them up, and which wasn't true.
Right. As I say, I think you show that in the book a number of times, trying to show that the movement towards civil rights, or as you term them, they're also freedom rights in the book, that isn't really the case, that there was plenty going on, but the repercussions were so deadly.
Right.
And that's why the book is bloody.
Right. I mean, one of the things that we forget about is how violent the South was and how violent segregation and Jim Crow was. I mean, it wasn't just the fact that somebody couldn't drink at a water fountain. It was that violence was used to maintain this institution of white supremacy. And that violence created fear. And it was that worrying concern about that fear that kept people from challenging inequality and white supremacy publicly.
Now, the events in this book happened around 50 years ago. When you talk to the young people that are that were in this county in Lowndes, what kind of perspective did they bring to it? How did they relate to these? Were they just ancient history, or did they have a sense that it was something that their parents or grandparents were active participants in?
It was a real mix. For some people, it was very current. But unfortunately, for many people, for many young people, it was distant history. I was surprised by how many people, even in Lowndes County itself, didn't really know the history of this remarkable movement that happened in their own hometown, in their own backyard. I spoke with a lady in an interview, and she was commenting on this very thing. And she had worked in the school system for many years, and she was the daughter of somebody who was active in the movement. And she said one day that there was a group from, I want to say Amsterdam, who had come over and were on a civil rights tour and were going through Alabama and stopped in Lowndes County. It was school kids. And she was struck by the fact that they knew more about the Lowndes County freedom struggle and the Lowndes County freedom organization, independent politics, coming from across the Atlantic than the kids who were growing up in the county, which speaks, one, to somewhat of an indictment against the public school systems and school systems there, but also is really problem reflects America, an issue that America has and not really wrestling with and dealing with and keeping current African-American, really American history.
Mm-hmm. So when you had talked to the current Alabama residents, what do they think about it today? How do they respond to it today? For those who did remember it, what were the reactions like when you started bringing up some of this stuff from 50 years ago?
Again, it depends upon who you ask. Mm-hmm. You know, on the white side, there was a lot of reluctance to even talk about it. Well, that's in the past. Those things happened. We've gotten over them. Things weren't quite as bad as we thought they were. Outsiders made them worse. I mean, so there's a lot of, there was significant reluctance to deal with, you know, the history, to admit participation in various terrorist organizations, like the White Citizens Council, for example. Mm-hmm. So on that side, it was a lot of reluctance. And things are better left alone, and let's not discuss and let's not talk about it. But on the African-American side, there was a much greater willingness to talk about the history. And can't tell you how many people were glad to talk about it and hadn't had a chance to talk about it in years. Mm-hmm. And we're really excited that I was attempting to recover and capture and put in print this important history.
You write a lot about the history of the whole movement, and there's one person I noticed, is it Hewlett?
John Hewlett.
Sort of that person seemed to have been a pivotal figure, that he went from a civil rights sort of activist. He was integral in creating one of the first organizations that went to register for the vote, mm-hmm. was turned away, but later on he becomes a political boss and seems to have been as negative in the final say as he was positive mm-hmm. in the beginning. Seems like a fascinating character to build a story on, because you see this big arc of a character that doesn't go at all the way you think it's going to go.
Yeah, you know, and John Hewlett is really a central figure in the history and in the story. And one of the, you asked earlier about going down and sort of doing ethnographic history and doing these oral interviews. Mm-hmm. You know, as a training in graduate school, you're always taught to prepare before you have an interview. And when I had moved down to Alabama and was doing sort of archival research, finally said, okay, now's the time for me to head on into Lowndes County, which is just mm-hmm. west of Montgomery. And so I said, yeah, I have to get a feel for the place. I'm going to write about the place, not just the history. I have to get a feel for the place, see where things are, where are trees, what does the courthouse feel like and look like. Mm-hmm. And so I head into the county and I'm just sort of walking around in sort of jeans and a T-shirt, and I'm walking through the county courthouse, and a lady stops me. And she says, this is near the end of late 90s. She says, you know, nice southern hospitality, you know, how you doing? You know, what's going on? Can I help you? And I said, oh, I'm just here doing a little research on the civil rights movement. And she said, oh, are you familiar with John Hewlett? And I said, yeah, but you know, whatever happened to him? I thought did he die sometime, you know, a while ago? I said, oh, no, he's a probate judge. In fact, he's right next door. Let me call, and you can go over to interview him. Now, for me, I'm like, oh, my goodness, this is wonderful, but at the same time, I'm absolutely horrified because where are my notes? You know, where's the preparation? I didn't have any time to do that. And so I went over, and he turned out to be a really gracious individual and a fantastic resource. But I didn't know what happened in writing this story. You don't always know in writing history what happens in the end. And I didn't know what happened to the Independent Political Party, to people like John Hewlett, as they became involved in the movement after sort of the heyday of the movement. And one of the things that I found is that although they created this radically independent, radically democratic moment of political possibility in the 60s, by the time we get to after the 70s into the 80s and the 90s, we find a replication, a shift away from those democratic politics towards more traditional American politics. And so there is an arc in the story mm-hmm. about challenging power, trying to create a new democratic political practice. And then once people are actually in power, what are the forces that wind up pulling them in different directions away from what I call in the book freedom politics and towards more traditional American politics? So in that sense, it becomes a little disappointing, but there are lessons to be learned in that, and I try to pull them out.
Has John Hewlett read the book? Has he responded to it, or what do you
think? No, well, that's a part of the delicate dance. Unfortunately, he passed away 3 years ago in 2006, but we had some discussions towards the end about it. And I said, you know, listen, this is what people are saying, and this is how people feel. I mean, it wasn't a big secret. You know, he said, listen, I do what I have to do now that I'm in office, and, you know, it's just politics. Politics is politics. But the sad thing is, when they got into it, it wasn't because politics were politics. It was because they were trying to create something different, trying to really open up democracy. And so part of the story is, how do people move away from that moment of democratic possibility?
Viola Liuzzo. I'm not pronouncing that right.
Liuzzo
mm-hmm. was a white woman from Detroit who traveled to Alabama for the Selma March and ended up being murdered by the Ku Klux Klan because she was helping move. She was driving at least one protester from Selma to Montgomery or
right.
the other way around. Her murder was influential in gaining support for the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Since she was murdered in Lowndes County, how did it influence the situation in Lowndes? And I'm curious what. Are there monuments there today, or what's the repercussion to that besides the Voting Rights Act?
Well, a couple things. One, there is a marker at the place where she was murdered, and unfortunately, every couple of years it gets desecrated by some folk who are sort of hostile to sort of the memory of the history of the civil rights movement. So now there's a iron fence around it to sort of protect it as sort of a sacred space. Mm-hmm. But in the moment, there's a bit of historical irony because it just so happens that she was in Lowndes County. She wasn't working there. She was working really with the Selma to Montgomery March, but really was reflective of how violent, in a way, the situation was for anybody who was engaged in sort of civil rights activism. You know, once she's murdered, although she wasn't there, the movement had already started. People look at that and say, you know what, it can happen to her. It can happen to any of us. That was one thing. But the other thing that plays out that's central to sort of the Liuzzo story in Lowndes County is that her trial, eventually, those who committed the murder are caught very quickly and they're put on trial in Lowndes County. But an all-white jury, as happens so often in the history throughout the South, an all-white jury refused to convict them. And so there were several, refused to convict the perpetrators. So there were several trials. And eventually in a federal court, they are convicted. But it speaks to sort of that struggle. And then eventually, one of the things that comes out of the Lowndes movement is this effort to get integrated juries. One of the court cases in Alabama, mm-hmm. One of the ways white supremacy was maintained was by having all white juries. And you couldn't get a conviction for anybody who was challenging white supremacy because of these all white juries. Eventually, a Liuzzo jury is seated that's integrated, that has African-American jurors in 1966. But even the African-American jurors who were selected, all people who were active in the movement, were not allowed to sit on the jury. But those African-Americans who were selected refused to convict. And afterwards, in the interviews afterward, even the prosecutor said, well, I knew that was going to happen because they understood what the repercussions would be right. for themselves if they convicted these white men for killing this white woman who was supportive of the movement.
Being from Brooklyn, did you have a sense of, when you were down there, that I'm curious, the people thought you were there just to sort of agitate it from the outside again? Because as you're describing all this stuff, all of the formation of the juries and everything, it's all very local kinds of things. It has to go to a federal level to get something else. But, you know, you're going to represent as, very much an outsider mm-hmm. and coming in. Was that something that you also had to be sensitive to or
get
problems with?
No, I did. More so on the white side than on the African-American side. Mm-hmm. I mean, the archivists and those who sort of collect history were very open and welcoming. I spent countless days in the state archives, and it was mm-hmm. a wonderful place with great people. But when you got into the county and really started to talk to people, particularly on the white side, there was a real hesitance, a real reluctance, and to a certain extent, a real resentment for dredging up the past. These were things that happened in the past. It was difficult history. Let's move on. Those were the progressives.
some of the non-progressives were, listen, it was we were right. It's unfortunate that this thing played out the way it did. But you're the last person in the world that I want to talk to about this. Mm-hmm. But on the African-American side, it was just the opposite. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, it was that enthusiasm for somebody to really capture this perspective and to write a story about the people on the ground, not just the outside organizers.
Have you gotten responses from the people that you interviewed? Did you show them the drafts or just the end result? And I'm curious about kind of responses you got then, if you saw that same sort of dual nature being reflected by the same populations.
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, one of the things that happened is some of the early drafts with people who I were interviewing who were very helpful in sending me to different people to interview. Mm-hmm. You got to have that access. You know, you get the name, somebody refers you to somebody else. Is that suddenly drafts started circulating in the community. And I would get emails from people saying, oh, you know, you
independent of your distribution?
Exactly.
So they copied it off and they sent it to somebody else.
Yeah, it was just
email
sort of this underground thing happening, you know, mm-hmm. and which I thought was fantastic because people were engaging in what I had written. Mm-hmm. And almost across the board, I mean, people were those who took the time to sit down and read it and different aspects of it and send me an email or give me a phone call were overwhelmingly positive.
Well, I'd like to ask you a couple questions about being a writer, and you can apply these to the book or some other things. Since you're a PhD in history, you've undoubtedly written other things, right?
I have, correct.
Okay. So what is the best part about being a writer for you, maybe as you're researching this book and working on it?
I think it's two aspects of it. I mean, one is the research. Mm-hmm. Whether it's fiction or nonfiction, you find some of the, you know, not all thoughts just spring freshly formed from your head. There's some sort of muse. And, well, for the historian, it's the research. It's finding these little tidbits, and you know, and it takes a lot of time. And, you know, you're spending hours in an archive, and then flipping through pages and page after page after page, and then you finally see something that says, "Aha! This is what I've been looking for." And then taking that small piece of information and fleshing it out, and crafting and weaving a story around it. And then finding and filling it out with other archival information, and then going and writing about it and saying, okay, how do I capture the essence of what I found here? As a writer, that's very exciting.
What was your favorite little something that you found that you then got to flesh out? What was a really big aha moment for you when you were writing this book, for example?
There are a couple. There are a couple big aha moments. One of the things, just broadly configured, is I started this book looking at 1965, and as a historian, I was very interested in origins. And so I kept going back and back and back and back looking for these origins. I was like, well, how do these rural folk embrace or come to embrace black power? We often think of black power as being an urban phenomenon, an urban northern phenomenon. But here were these rural folk who really define black power. And then as I was looking back, I began to have a series of aha moments. As I found that, you know, what they were doing in 1965, organizing for political power, organizing their own institutions and for economic autonomy and for social autonomy, that this is what they had been doing for generations. And so dating back to emancipation, finding, you know, evidence of them organizing their own independent schools, organizing a farmer's co-op at the turn of the century, Du Bois, W.B. Du Bois down there writing about these things, those were moments where I was excited to find information, but then it also really illuminated this much larger phenomenon of, well, why do things happen in 1965 and play out the way that they do?
Okay, so getting all the background, which is probably why you're a historian. What's the worst part about being a writer?
Well, I mean, writing is hard, right? I mean, you can't be confused about that. Writing is difficult. And so I think there's two aspects. One, trying to figure out exactly how to say what it is you want to say. And for me, often I sort of think of that as sort of writer's block. Well, two things, right? Either one, you don't know what you really want to say, so you can't write it, or the frustration of knowing what you want to say, but not finding the words, not being able to craft that sentence or paragraph or that transition that will allow you to say it the way you want to do. And then you got to go back to the drawing board and completely rewrite it. Or move some things around. That's one side. The other side is on the research side, and as a historian, it's you're committed to tell the truth. You know, there were times when I was like, oh man, this would be a great story if I just tweak this here or change that there, but that's not what our charge is. Right? I mean, we have our own oath that we have to take, if you will, mm-hmm. And that is to uncover the truth whether you like it or not. And so being wedded to that, And so the writer in me wants to take off in a different direction sometimes. And you said, well, that's not where the evidence leads me.
Do you do other kinds of writing? Are there other genres that you work at?
Not so much. I mean, I dabble and play around, but my sort of creative writing really finds more expression in reading fiction and stuff like that.
What's the best writing job you've had?
I would say this.
Okay.
And when I say this, I mean sort of being able to write my book on Lowndes County, mm-hmm. and being a writer as a history professor, because I'm able to write whatever I want to write. There's no limits on topic. There's no limit on subject. There's no limit on chronology. And so there's free rein. So, you know, I came up with the topic because that's what I wanted to do. I was interested in SNCC. I was interested in Lowndes County. And so, you know, go ahead and make it happen.
What's the worst writing job you've had?
I worked when I was in undergraduate school doing some research for a professor, and he was writing a dictionary, sort of a dictionary of biographies and stuff like that. Oh, and it was absolutely dreadful. You know, because there was research involved, and you're writing these formulaic sort of entries, mm-hmm. and it was painful. But it was useful as practice, because writing, you know, is craft, is practice. But it was not exciting at all.
Okay. What would you do if you weren't a writer or a historian? What other things do you think you might get into? What do you dream of?
Realistically? Or, you know, I always had this, and unfortunately, I think my window is closing rather quickly, of playing professional baseball. But that is, that again, that window, the steroids era is over. I don't think that's going to be able to help me. So that window is closing rapidly. But
that window closed on me when I was about two.
Exactly. And then I think it might have closed for me around that same time as well. Okay. But the dream was always still there. And so actually one of the things that I do enjoy a little bit and have been able to work in somewhat is writing about sports. Not for a newspaper or anything, but, you know, sort of the historical aspects of sports, mm-hmm. And teaching about sports and race in America.
So baseball is your sport?
Baseball would be my sport.
Okay. Baseball. And that's the one you'd want to write about?
That's the one I would want to write about. It was very. Then there's a lot there. I mean, it mirrors sort of American history, particularly in the modern era, post-1965, mm-hmm. 1865. It's a rich history, the Negro Leagues and industry. I mean, it really is a rich history.
Oh, Columbus has a couple of, I think, baseball teams that are the old style, you know, baseball teams as well, the historical mm-hmm. style. They play at the Ohio Historical Center mm-hmm. every mm-hmm. now and then. Who's your biggest influence? There are a lot of historians whose names we've come to know, and I'm curious, do you pattern some of your thoughts after that, or some of the writing style? Who is it that you really look to as a great historical writer?
Well, I think there's a mix of people, and I sort of have been drawing on and looking to different people over the years. My area of expertise and specialty is African American history, so there are a number of great African American historians and African American writers over the years who I've really looked to for inspiration, to sort of pick up where in some instances they left off. I think John Hope Franklin immediately comes to mind, perhaps because he just passed away. But he has always served, for me and for so many other historians for generations, somebody to model my craft after. But then there's also the luminaries of W.E.B. Du Bois. And when I found him down in Lowndes County, living there for half a year in 1906, to be able to walk in his shadow, follow in his footsteps in my own little way to talk about this history a decade later, was really something that I found inspiring.
This probably goes back to the baseball thing, but what's your secret vice of an author or a genre, something that people would be surprised to know that a serious historical scholar would really like to read?
Well, for me, I think it's a mix. I mean, one, I'm writing, you know, on this, you know, African-American activism and, you know, civil rights and black power in the 60s, and I actually enjoy to a great deal not just science fiction, but fantasy novels. And mm-hmm. I've been deep into this series by George R.R. Martin, A Game of Thrones. And I've been, you know, I started in graduate school, and I've been, you know, looking forward to it. Each edition, each book in this series that comes out. So my wife gets on me a little bit about it, and she says, yeah, that's real revolutionary. But I said, it's about politics. It's about politics, right? You know, it's, and I'm also part of the Dungeons & Dragons generation.
So oh, now, see, now you've gone too far. Really, that, I shouldn't have let you go that far in talking about it. Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you today, and I recommend the book Bloody Lowndes, Civil Rights and Black Power in America's Black Belt, and Alabama's Black Belt, I'm sorry. And here's the book. It's available July 1st.
July 1.
And be at Amazon and find booksellers everywhere. And we thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.